The laws of Leviticus appear to be entirely separate from the narrative and themes of the Torah so far. Exodus, by contrast, picks up directly from the narrative of Genesis, and as we've seen, even the case laws in Exodus sometimes make subtle references to earlier stories. But when we enter Leviticus, we feel ourselves to be in another kind of book entirely. There's no narrative at all here in the first parsha. Instead, the book opens by listing the various types of korbanot, sacrificial offerings, and giving us the precise details involved in their ritual preparation. Speaking directly to the priest, absorbed in the procedural realm of the Mishkan, it's as if this middle book of the Torah is detached from the world that has come before it. Yet, even here, in the intricacies of the sacrificial system, the meaning of the text is informed by its relationship to earlier narratives. Korbanot do not appear in the Torah for the first time here in Leviticus. A look back at where a particular offering has appeared previously in the Torah can therefore offer context and provide a deeper understanding of the meaning and purpose of this korban. This approach is particularly helpful in the case of the first three of the korbanot mentioned in Leviticus, the Olah, Mincha, and Shlamim. The Torah gives no explanation of what situation would prompt someone to bring these particular offerings. They're simply named, as in verse 3, Im Olah Korbano, if one's korban is an Olah. The word Olah literally means goes up. Hence, it is alternately translated as the elevation offering or the burnt offering because it all gets burnt and goes up in smoke. But when does a person bring an Olah? Well, when has an Olah been brought before? The first person we have on record offering this kind of sacrifice is Noah. After the flood has receded and he comes out of the ark, we read, Vayiven Noach Mizbeach Lashem. Noah built an altar to the Eternal. Vikach mikol ha-behema ha-torah, and he took from every pure animal, umikol ha-of ha-tahor, and from every pure bird, vaya'al olot ba-mizbeach, and he brought olot upon the altar. Now, we can already begin to speculate on what might have compelled Noah to bring this offering. And surely it was meant to express some sense of gratitude to God for having survived the global catastrophe of the flood. But we can push past the particulars of the Noah story by comparing it to another instance of Olah offering. The other figure in Genesis who offers an Olah is Abraham. Our first patriarch's Olah offering was initially to be offered not in the form of a beast or a bird, but his own son. Vayomer, and God said, Kachnat bincha, please take your son, your only son, whom you love, Yitzchak, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as an Olah. Vahalehu sham le'olah, on one of the mountains I will point out to you. Avram takes his son and immediately sets off to follow God's instruction. When they come to the mountain, Avram builds an altar, lays out the wood, and then binds his son and places him on top. But as he takes up the knife to slaughter his son, suddenly an angel calls to him from the heavens and tells him to stop. Avram has proven that he fears God, and Yitzchak's life will be spared. Avram's first response is not to vocalize his gratitude to God, but to continue with the task of bringing an Olah offering. Vayisa Avraham etenav. When Avraham looked up, he saw, behold, a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. So Avraham went and took the ram and offered it up as an Olah in place of his son. Vayikach et ha'ayil v'yalehu le'olah tachat bano. We can begin to establish a pattern. Both of these olot, Noach's and Avraham's, are offered after passing through a threat of death and surviving. Both put forth animals as substitutes for the human lives that might have been lost. And both result in a promise from God to either bless humanity, in Avraham's case, or at least not to curse them again, in Noach's. Returning to Leviticus, then, we may presume that someone who brings an olah to the Mishkan might also have passed through some great trial, and in a mixture of relief and continuing trepidation, is hoping to ward off the possibility of further calamity. Can we do similar work with a mincha? The first such offering takes us back again to the early chapters of Genesis. Vayihi miketz yamim, and it was after many days, vayave Kain mipri adama mincha lashem. Kain brought from the fruit of the soil a mincha to the Eternal. Kain is expressing his gratitude for the produce he has been able to cultivate from the ground. So he offers some of it to God as a kind of tribute. His brother, Hevel, sees Kain's offering and brings forth one of his own, also referred to as a mincha. Vehevel hevi gamhu mibchorot tzono, and Hevel he too brought from the first of his flock. Ve'yisa Hashem el Hevel ve'el minchato, and the Eternal paid heed to Hevel and to his mincha. The general principle seems to be that when one receives abundance from one's labors, it's good to thank God by giving some of that bounty back through a mincha offering. But there is another very different kind of mincha that is offered in Genesis, one given not to God in thanks for abundance, but to a powerful human being in an attempt to placate him. Yaakov gives one of these in preparing to re-encounter his brother Esav, whom he fears still wishes to kill him. Ve'yikach min habab yado mincha le'esav achiv. He selected from what had come into his hands a mincha for his brother Esav. Again, the mincha is an offering of a portion of the abundance that someone has labored to grow, but this time it's being offered as a tribute to a human being rather than to God. Does this have anything to do with the mincha offerings to God? Yaakov's description of it seems to indicate that there is a parallel. Vayomer Yaakov, Yaakov said to Esav, "No, please, if I have found favor in your eyes, accept from me this mincha. V'lakachta minchati miyadi. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God, and you have received me favorably." This mincha is not only an expression of thanks for what one has, but also an attempt to find favor in the eyes of someone more powerful. Perhaps in describing the encounter with Esav as something like seeing the face of God, Yaakov is presuming that the purpose of a mincha offering is to gain some intimacy with the receiver. The mincha offering in Leviticus, then, can also be understood as an attempt to maintain or strengthen one's relationship with God, not just as a thanks for what one has gained, but also in hopes of continuing to receive God's favor. Finally, what about the shlamim? The root of the word, shin lamed mem, means whole, and can be used to indicate many different kinds of wholeness, including peace or payment, completeness or satisfaction. But when and why would someone bring an offering in response to a sense of wholeness? There's only one earlier mention of a shlamim offering in the Torah. At the end of Parshat Mishpatim, the children have just witnessed the revelation at Mount Sinai and received the first major code of laws. And Moshe leads them in a ceremony that's both an affirmation and a celebration. And he begins by building an altar at the foot of the mountain. Vayishlach et narei bnei Yisrael v'yalu olot. V'yizvechu zvachim shlamim l'Hashem parim. He sent some young men among the Israelites, and they offered olot and sacrificed bulls as zvachim shlamim to the Eternal. The people have just had a transcendent experience. They've been given a new set of principles to live by, and they've been brought into a covenant with God. Surely this represents an unparalleled sense of completion and well-being. If anything merited a wholeness offering, it was this glorious moment. Note, however, that Moshe and his appointees did not only offer shlamim offerings, they also offered olot. That's a curious mixture. Haven't we learned from Noah and Abraham that the olah was offered after passing through a terrible threat of death and destruction? Why would Moshe signal a note of high anxiety here alongside these spirited declarations of well-being? But of course, that's precisely the point. The revelation at Mount Sinai was exhilarating and indeed fulfilling. It brought our people into a new reality and a greater sense of purpose in the world. It brought them into contact with God, and so it made them whole. But it was also a terrifying experience. The people were overwhelmed and worried they would die, pen namut, if they heard any more of God's voice. They asked Moshe to speak to God for them from then on, and he agreed. Never again did they wish to face this kind of terror. So indeed, it was also a time to offer olot. As we trace the history of each of the korbanot back into the earlier books of the Torah, we begin to learn the language of the sacrificial system. Each korban represented a unique expression of sentiment, designed to respond to some significant human experience. We can therefore come to read the offerings as we might read letters or notes, each one projecting a particular frequency, which can then be translated into a kind of prayer. Those notes might even be combined, two or three sounding at once, in the form of multiple offerings, as we attempt to process the sometimes conflicting emotions that make up the content of our spiritual lives. And so, as we read through the Korbanot of Parshat Vayikra, even centuries after the sacrificial system has ended, we can imagine the kinds of experiences in our own lives that each of these offerings was meant to address. When we read about the Shlamim and recall that first great feeling of wholeness our people experienced around Mount Sinai, perhaps we will imagine ourselves in other moments of well-being and completion, when we ascended to a new level of awareness. A wedding, a graduation, a siyum. And perhaps when we come across the mincha, we will consider those moments of great fortune and abundance in our lives that might easily slip away if we forget to offer gratitude for what we have and to prepare for the next challenge. What kind of mincha can we give when we get a new job, a new car, or a new apartment? And finally, when we remember the olot offered by Noach and Abraham after they came so terrifyingly close to death, perhaps we will wonder what kind of equivalent prayer we might offer after a car accident, or a global pandemic, or the freeing of a hostage. Leviticus thus becomes not just a repository of ancient temple rituals, but a book that attempts to give us tools for mapping out the complex journey of the human soul.